Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We welcome our radio and online audiences and our audience here at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. It's my great pleasure to introduce my friend and colleague, Steve Machtinger, attorney and also a violist, and the San Joaquin River School of Music, a quintet to play the music that goes with this speech, Yes, We Can't, Mozart and the Sublime. So Kant's idea of the sublime combined with Mozart's expression of them, Steve Machtinger. Something special.
I'd like to start with a question. Did anybody notice how many times George hit the hammer on the podium when he started? Three times, right? Okay, we're going to get to that, but I want you to hold that thought about how he convened a meeting of thinking people to talk about philosophy. Speaking of thinking people, today is the 225th anniversary to the day that the delegates convened in Philadelphia to begin the Constitutional Convention. And that was an amazing group of people, Ben Franklin, James Madison, George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, incredible collection of forward and enlightened thinking. At the exact same time in Europe, in Vienna to be exact, Mozart was putting the finishing touches on the piece that we're going to play for you tonight, the Viola Quintet K-516. K, by the way, stands for Kerschel, who is the person who cataloged all of Mozart's works. They're all in consecutive order. So this was the 516th piece that he wrote. And if you ever want to explore the numerology and want to know how old Mozart was when he wrote a piece, you take the K number and divide by 25 and add 10, and that's how old Mozart was. So in 1787, he was 31 years old. It was an amazing time. Other things were going on. Kant was just a few hundred miles away doing his critique of pure reason. Goethe was doing the second edition of one of the great novels of the German Enlightenment. The very next month, Gibbon in England was putting the final touches on his monumental Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. And Haydn, in the same town as Mozart, was writing an amazing series of string quartets. So this was called the Age of Enlightenment, also known as the Age of Reason. And according to some writers, the Age of Reason began somewhere around 1700 and ended around 1890. It had a whole bunch of forces that led to this incredible outpouring of intellectual energy. Maybe it started with the invention of the printing press in 1440. The discoveries of Copernicus and Galileo and Newton, and then the incredible burst of commercial energy, of colonization and trade and plunder of the New World and the accumulation of wealth, which led to leisure time, which allowed people to reflect in a new way, a secular way, because people had been emancipated finally from the teachings of the church and no longer needed to, and or were able to accept as dogma what the church had been telling them for hundreds and hundreds of years. And so people started to reflect, and so we had an outpouring of philosophy. So this combination of wealth, scientific discoveries, and new thinking led to a new area of philosophy called aesthetics. The first use of the word aesthetics was in around 1735. And the reason that aesthetics came into the public discourse. It was partly because people were accumulating objects for collection, and they needed a way to value them because they were also able to trade and exchange them. And so they also needed some new non-ecclesiastical way of valuing objects. So the market had a need for a new kind of philosophy, and aesthetics was what filled it. So people began to talk about, well, what is beauty? And as soon as they started talking about beauty, they talked about the limitations of beauty and came up with a new concept called the sublime. It actually wasn't a new concept. It was first discussed in ancient Greece in the first century. And the earliest reference we have to the concept is by an author. We don't really know who he was, but we call him Longinus. His work on the sublime was translated into English in 1739. Someone else had defined the sublime, and so Longinus didn't feel a need to define it, but he had many illustrations of it. And the most famous one in his book is the quotation from the Bible, where it says, "And God said, let there be light, and there was light." And so this becomes the epitome of the sublime, something fast and sudden and awe-inspiring. Then Edmund Burke became interested in the topic. And he was an ambitious young philosopher, and he made his mark with a book in 1757 called A Philosophical Inquiry into the Origin of Our Ideas of the Sublime and the Beautiful. And he wrote that this was an inquiry into the properties of such things in nature as raise love and astonishment in us, and by showing in what manner they operate to produce these passions. And he said, terror in all cases whatsoever, either more openly or latently, is the ruling principle of the sublime. The sublime is characterized by vastness, obscurity, power, infinity, and difficulty. That pretty much describes the piece that you're going to hear later on. Kant got into the act, wrote a work in 1764 called Observations on the Feeling of the Beautiful and the Sublime, and discussed it in the Critique of Judgment. Kant is impossible to read, I was told. And then I decided I would try to read it for myself in English translation. And sure enough, it is impossible to read. Incomprehensible. Longinus, on the other hand, was very pleasurable to read, and I wound up enjoying reading Plato and some others. But Kant is very obscure. So he divided the sublime into two categories, what he called the quantitative sublime and the dynamic sublime. And the quantitative sublime is a feeling evoked by sheer vastness of scale, such as the emotional effect of confronting the size of the pyramids in Egypt, or the experience upon entering St. Peter's Cathedral in Rome for the first time. And the dynamic sublime supposedly sets the mind in motion, as opposed to the feeling of restful contemplation you get when you're observing a beautiful object. So the sublime ultimately is a feeling that we have, and the way Kant ultimately put it was that it's a feeling that elevates the soul and prepares the soul for its journey after death. And so the sublime takes on a moral quality. We should lead our lives in a way that elevates our soul so that when death comes, we're prepared for it. And so this finally brings us to Mozart. On April 4th, 1787, Mozart was in the middle of writing a letter to his father, Leopold, when he was suddenly interrupted with news that his father was very ill, and as it turned out, fatally ill. His father was quite old, and he and Mozart had had a very difficult relationship. Leopold had noticed very early on that Mozart was going to be his ticket, his meal ticket, and he turned Mozart into a money machine and took him all over Europe and basically exploited him. Mozart finally tore himself away and moved to Vienna and had made a career for himself and left his father behind in Salzburg. And so in his letter he wrote to his father, "This very moment I have received some news that distresses me very much. This all the more as I gathered from your last letter that you were, thank God, doing very well. But now I hear that you are really ill. I need not tell you how much I'm longing to hear some reassuring news from you yourself. And indeed, I confidently expect such news, although I've made it a habit to imagine the worst in all situations. As death, if we think about it soberly, is the true and ultimate purpose of our life, I have over the past several years formed such a knowing relationship with this true and best friend of humankind that his image holds nothing terrifying for me anymore. Instead, it holds much that is soothing and consoling. And I thank my God that he has blessed me with the insight, you know what I mean, which makes it possible for me to perceive death as the key to our ultimate happiness. I never lie down at night without thinking that perhaps as young as I am, I will not live to see another day. And yet no one who knows me can say that I am morose or dejected in company. And for this blessing, I thank my Creator every day and sincerely wish the same blessing for all my fellow human beings." And then he closed by saying, he remarked on the untimely death of my dearest and best friend. "He had just turned 31, my age, but I do not grieve for him, only for myself and all those who knew him as well as I did." So Mozart's description of death as our best friend was taken almost verbatim from a book that was found on his bookshelf when he himself died just 4 years later. And it was a book by Moses Mendelssohn, who was the father, the grandfather of Felix Mendelssohn, the composer, and who had become a famous philosopher and is now considered the founder of the Jewish Reform Movement. And Mendelssohn had written a book called Phaedo, or On the Immortality of the Soul, which was an updated German version of the Phaedo that appears as the last volume of the Final Days of Socrates by Plato. And he had updated it to be an enlightened version. And I'll just read you a couple sentences from it. He has Socrates tell his acolytes, you know the story, Socrates is about to be executed by drinking hemlock for supposed crimes against the state. And his acolytes have surrounded him and are very unhappy. And he's comforting them by telling them that there's nothing to fear from death. And in the Mendelssohn version, Socrates reasons from the irrefutable tendency and impulse in rational beings to a state more perfect. We have ample grounds to believe their perfection is the final end of creation. We may conclude that this world has been produced for the existence of spirits, which might elevate themselves by degrees to perfection and feel their utmost happiness in their progress toward it. And he draws a moral lesson from this. Whoever adheres to the performance of his duties with fortitude and constancy of temper and bears adversity with patient resignation to the will of God will deserve and enjoy at the last recompense of his virtues, whereas he who has trod in the paths of vice cannot leave this world without acknowledging in some way or other that evil doing is not the road to happiness. In short, God would impeach his wisdom, goodness, and justice if he had created rational beings and suffered them to make a progress to perfection for a limited term only. So that's his argument and philosophical proof of the immortality of the soul. What I'd like to do now is turn to this work that Mozart wrote immediately upon receiving this letter. The setting is that Mozart had conducted one of the first performances of Don Giovanni in Prague in January 1787, and he'd received a commission. He conducted one of the first performances of The Marriage of Figaro, and he received at that time commission to write a new opera, and he decided to write Don Giovanni, but he needed a libretto. And his librettist, Lorenzo De Ponte, had taken on two other assignments. And so for the next several months, De Ponte was juggling different tasks, and Mozart didn't get the libretto until June. So on April 4th, he was writing a viola quintet that he planned to sell for publication. Mozart was one of the first freelance musicians. He was not in the employ of the church or of the court. And so he wrote music for money. So he wrote one quintet, which was a very joyful work, and then he immediately turned to the piece we're about to play, the quintet in G minor. And then in June, he got the libretto and went to work on Don Giovanni, which was premiered that fall. These two works, The Marriage of Figaro and Don Giovanni, are considered the greatest operas of Mozart and probably the greatest operas of anyone. So what we're going to do is go through this quintet and see to what extent Mozart's philosophy, his letter to his father, his reading of Moses Mendelssohn is reflected in the work. Okay, so we're going to start with just the first theme. We'll be playing just a few excerpts and try to decipher what Mozart was getting at. So we'll start with just the first theme. Theme one, and I'd like to take that apart and ask Zina, and let me introduce our musicians. We have Zina Schiff and Joyce Lee, Oscar Hasbun and Luella Hasbun, all very dear friends. We've all been playing together in the Marin Symphony, except for Zina, who has been a soloist with the Marin Symphony, and we didn't time this event to coincide with the anniversary of the Constitutional Convention. That's a coincidence. We scheduled this because Zina is visiting town for a recital, and so we were glad to have her with us. So I'm going to ask Zina to play the very first bar of the piece. All right, that's what we call a G minor arpeggio. It's ascending. Very simple, straightforward, and let's hear the last three notes of that. All right, there are your three knocks of the gavel. You're going to be hearing a lot of that. That's an element here. Mozart was a member of the Freemasons, and they had a whole numerology, and the best example of it is the magic flute. Where you have the three boys and the three assistants to the Queen of the Night, and all and various other things. And in our culture, we have threes, and these go in many cultures. We have the three Billy Goats Gruff and the three Little Pigs and the three Stooges, and they all have their symbolic meaning. But you're going to hear these three knocks on the door. So my interpretation of this first bar is that this is our character. I call him our hero. He's questing and is searching, and he's honest and straightforward because he approaches us with a serious G minor arpeggio. And now let's listen to the second bar. Now, that's the same rhythm, ba-ba-da-ba-ba-ba. It ends with those same three knocks on the door. Same rhythm, but a different melody. And this melody, for sure, has symbolic content. It's a descending chromatic. Can we hear it one more time? And at Mozart's time and ever since, and before as well, that descending chromatic signifies death. It signifies a lamentation. It appears in Bach in the B minor mass at the time that Jesus is dying in the crucifixus scene. There's a descending chromatic. Mozart learned all about Bach in the home of Baron von Swieten, where he and Haydn and others met every Sunday. And when Mozart was exposed to Bach, he encountered for the first time in his life a genius comparable to his own. And he became obsessed with Bach, and he wrote down, he transcribed Bach works. And for sure he knew what the symbolism is. And one reason we know is that when he wrote Don Giovanni, just a few months later, there were two death scenes. Most of us know the story, but briefly, Don Giovanni is Don Juan, and he is an immoral lout. And in the very first scene, he molests the daughter of the commendatore, who's essentially the chief of police, and tries to escape. The commendatore chases him, challenges Don Giovanni to a duel, and Don Giovanni kills him with his sword. And as the commendatore is dying, Mozart has the orchestra play a descending chromatic. And then the other death scene is where the commendatore comes back as a spirit and drags Don Giovanni into hell. And that's the other time we hear a descending chromatic. So that's the most persuasive proof of what Mozart had in mind when he wrote that. So from the first two bars, we already have a prophecy that our hero is doomed to die. And we know that this is about the hero because it's the same rhythmic motif that identifies our hero. And now let's hear the third bar. There's a wonderful book by Albert Schweitzer about Bach, and he goes into all of these motifs and explains their meanings. And whenever you hear pairs of notes, that signifies sighing and sobbing and grieving. And he gives examples from his cantatas where this sighing figure of pairs of notes accompanies grieving about the tragedy of whatever Bach is writing about, which is usually has to do with the death of his savior. Schweitzer writes that when you have the sighing theme at very close intervals, either a half step or one step apart, that signifies the death of a noble person. And so we already know in three bars that our hero is a noble person who is destined to die, and there will be an outpouring of grief. So we're now going to hear theme two, and we're going to just play four bars of that. Well, Schweitzer didn't tell us what this theme signifies, but I believe that it signifies something from the other world. It's something eerie. It's something initially seductive and alluring and attractive, but something that stings. And the reason I think it stings is in the third bar. Let's hear the cello and violin. That's very dissonant. That's called a minor ninth, which is about as dissonant as you can get. And Mozart makes sure that it's dissonant because he has a pickup note to it with an open D, which is the same note the cello had, which creates a continuing dissonance. And just for emphasis, he has an accent on it, and then he has the inner strings play an offbeat accent, So the whole thing is kind of thrown off. There's something else odd about this, and I'm just going to take a moment to talk about the structure of this piece. And I think it's worth going into because the structure of this movement is the same structure as just about every first movement of any classical piece of music, whether it's a symphony, a piano sonata, a string quartet, a piano trio, string quintet. They all follow what's called a sonata allegro form. And it starts with the first theme, which you've already heard, and then there's a contrasting second theme, which is always in a contrasting key. And then there will be a development section where the themes are explored and go into strange territory. Then they come back in a part called the recapitulation. And when they come back, the two themes are each stated in the same key, which symbolizes a kind of reconciliation. And it's on a subliminal level, it makes us feel that there's a sense of completion and harmony and closure. And then there's typically a coda in the main key. Mozart violates this rule in this piece, and this might be the only piece where that I know of where he does that. Theme one is in G minor, and the piece ends in G minor. That's why we call this the quintet in G minor. Now, since this is in a minor key, theme two ought to be in B flat major. That's G minor has two flats, B flat is the key of two flats. And Mozart wrote two other pieces right around this time in G minor, the Symphony No. 40 in G minor and the piano quartet in G minor. And in both of those pieces, theme two came in B flat major as a contrast. Here, theme two comes in G minor, the same key. And this his audience was perceptive enough probably to have noticed this right away, but they certainly would have felt it. And it has a feeling of an inappropriate closeness. And I think he did this on purpose to emphasize the insidiousness of this spirit theme. So we're going to play for you now the end of the exposition, right before the repeat. We are going to take the repeat because of something I'm going to get to explain to you in just a minute. Did you notice that it ended with three emphatic notes, each preceded by three notes? So we have that motive of three, and it's a fragment of the spirit theme. It's got a pickup and to an ascending note. The next time you hear it, instead of a group of three, you have two groups of three. And he does it one more time when you have three groups of three. And each time it's more insistent. And my interpretation of this piece is that Mozart has the spirit calling the hero, and our hero is ignoring the spirit. The hero is too busy, and there's an insistent, repeated locomotion of eighth notes that you'll hear throughout almost the entire piece, usually with the three inner strings accompanying both of the themes. And that represents the industry and the motion and the busyness of the hero. And the third time, the spirit is practically summoning our hero to wake up and listen to what he has to say. Then we get into the development section, which initially becomes an exploration of those three knocks on the door that we heard at the very beginning. And I want to just have us play the first 10 bars of the development section, what Mozart referred to as the fantasy section. At that point, we really get into the exploration of the hero theme and the spirit theme. And you'll hear both themes go into remote keys. This is sort of like the adventure where the hero explores the dangerous territory. And then you'll hear that it comes back to the original theme, which is the signal of the recapitulation. So it will feel, from a narrative point of view, that the hero has survived his explorations. But then everything goes off track, and it's as though he's just drowning in his in the grieving theme, really. And we're going to play that for you now. That's the part I think is sublime. So then eventually we get to a coda, and you'll hear that the hero theme has disappeared. And all that's left is the spirit theme and the death theme, and eventually even the grieving has gone. And we're just left with an empty spirit. And in my opinion, this is not exactly what Mozart was telling his father he truly believed. This is one of those moments that, like what you hear in opera, where the opera singers are saying something with their words and the orchestra is playing something that says that they're lying. And I think that's what's going on here. And as it turns out, Mozart was too busy with his work to ever visit his father again, even though he said that he needed to hold him in his arms one last time. He didn't go to his bedside. He didn't go to the funeral. He didn't go to the auction sale of his property. He accepted a check from his brother-in-law just to be done with it, and then he went right on to work on Don Giovanni, the lout who kills the father figure and goes to hell. So we're going to play the whole movement for you now, and I hope that you'll be able to follow along. I've described this as a narrative, and I think it's not a coincidence that this form, the Sonata Allegro form, was developed by Haydn and Mozart at exactly the same time that the novel was being developed, first in England and then by Goethe, Mozart's contemporary. And I think there's a reason for this. This was an era where people are reflecting on their own lives, and they put themselves in the role of the hero of the novel, or in the role of the hero of these wordless narratives. And people are trying, for the first time, to explore the meaning of their own lives for themselves, and not because some authority is telling them. That's really why they call this the Age of Reason and the Enlightenment, because thinking people are trying to figure this out for themselves. Thank you.
Say after that. All right. Well, we have time for Q&A. So thank you very much, Steve, and the San Joaquin River School of Music for that performance and the great ideas. Anyone who can weave Three Billy Goats Gruff into a concept about the sublime really understands his material. So we'll start with the questions now. And for the radio and online audiences, you're listening to a lecture at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. The lecture was by Steve Machtinger on Yes, We Can't, Mozart and the Sublime, and you just listened to the San Joaquin River School of Music play a viola quintet by Mozart. So, who would like to ask the first question? The mic is right there. Yeah. The mic is right there. Yeah. And those who have questions can get in line behind him so that it moves a little bit more smoothly. Thanks.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah.
I understand this piece is to be a synthesis and a conflicting contrast between the beautiful and the sublime. I interpret this delicate in the beginning piece of this music, this delicate step by step form that everyone likes about Mozart, very joyful, very light, One sees it in Ina Kleinenock music and other pieces. And I see a synthesis, a bit of both, and where one merges into the other, and one merges back into kind of a delicate, balanced beauty, and then an awesome kind of transcendental, sublime quality, rather than just exclusively sublime. That's how I understand it.
There are several different Mozarts. In the popular mind, there's the Mozart who wrote pretty music and beautiful music. When I told my younger sister that I was doing a lecture and talking about Mozart, she asked me, why didn't I pick someone deeper than Mozart? And there's a popular conception that Mozart is shallow and pretty, and that was probably true for the first 10 years of his career, but Mozart started writing music when he was 5 years old. And so he'd been writing music for 25, 26 years by the time he wrote this. And when ironically, the greatest child prodigy was probably Mendelssohn, who wrote masterpieces at age 16. Mozart didn't really write a masterpiece until he was about 19. And then when he moved to Vienna in 1781, he actually said he would write on different levels. He wanted to be pleasing to the ear for the less sophisticated listener. He also wanted it to be at a level that could be appreciated by the connoisseur. So I think your point is very well taken.
Maybe somebody could answer the question about Kant, whether he's totally obscure or not.
Got deeper and deeper into this. The most interesting thing as a performer was to see to what extent extra musical information could inform a performance of a work. And there's a prejudice among musicians that we should only play what's on the page, and we should only get we should just play what's written. And so I listened to various recordings, and they were all over the map. Some of the recordings play these very intense chords that you heard us play three times and six times, nine times. There's no dynamic marking. And if you read it literally, those should be quiet. And some of the performances, the Juilliard Quartet, one of the great chamber music ensembles, played those very softly. The famous Heifetz-Piatigorsky Primrose recordings played it more or less in the spirit that we did. And so we had to make some decisions. It's not written that way, but then if you have a narrative interpretation, you have to decide what kind of being the spirit is, and how would it be talking to Mozart, and how would Mozart be imagining it. And so we came up, it's not necessarily the right interpretation, but it's a consistent one. And so that informed how we bowed certain things, whether it would be on the string or off the string. Some people play the three knocks in a legato smooth way, but when we saw how the development part was written, with that you heard the two violins doing their tiptoeing into the treacherous territory, that was an echo of the beginning. So we really got at least my conclusion was that if you try to understand the narrative, it can actually help you make decisions that can give a coherence to the performance.
Well, I have a question about the performance. You work together as a quintet, and as you described the process of interpreting the music, do you verbalize this discussion ever, or do you just play and come to the conclusion by playing, or a little bit of both?
We only verbalize it when it's in preparation for a philosophy lecture at the Commonwealth Club.
And how often does that happen?
Once every 2 years, apparently.
Next question. Great.
I wanted to thank you very much for the lecture about Kant, and the lecture about Mozart. Could you elaborate a little bit on the particular connection between Kantian philosophy and this particular concerto?
Well, Kant was trying to create a rational explanation for things that had been taken on faith. And he said that he was going to do for human thought what Copernicus did for science. He was going to create his own Copernican revolution, and everything had to be approached rationally and without regard to what Aristotle or the Pope or anybody else said. And he spent his entire career in this little town, and he was a man of very regular habits, and he gradually published these systemized works. So he did talk about the sublime, and the way he described it was the sublime is something that we can know through reasoning, but that we can never experience, such as the afterlife. And the immortality of the soul. And there's no real indication that Mozart read or even cared about Kant. And it appears that he read Moses Mendelssohn, but I think he may well have just thumbed through it to be able to say something to his father that would be appropriate and get back to work. He cared really about music and creating drama and creating a life for himself apart from his father. But I think to the extent that he was in this work dealing with spirits and what does it mean to think about the other world, I think he was wrestling very deeply with the same kinds of issues, but expressing it through music, whereas Kant was expressing it through his writing.
But other than you connecting these two pieces, there is no actual connection that they would indicate in their work or otherwise, right?
Well, they were working at the same time. Vienna, I actually did a Google map search to see how you would get from Vienna to Königsberg, where Kant was working. Right. And it's a straight line almost due north. It turns out that if you were to take that line halfway through, you'd go through Poland to the little town where my father was born. So I found an actual connection there. My ancestors would have been peddlers on the highway. Kant really didn't think much about music, except he didn't think that it was worth a whole lot. He thought it was an inferior form of expression. Didn't really. He wrote some really mean things about it. And Mozart, I searched his letters. He wrote almost nothing about philosophy. We know Mozart was a Freemason and believed in when you join the Freemasons, you have to declare that you believe in a supreme being, but you don't have to define what that is. So I think what they had in common was that they were both men of the Enlightenment. They were free thinkers. They each were seeking. They were each seeking truth for themselves in the deepest part of their being. But I'm sure they never had any contact with each other whatsoever.
Thank you.
I think another way to look at that question too is any period of time. I mean, if you look at ancient Greece, time of Plato and Aristotle and Socrates and so on, and how much was accomplished then, the time of the Enlightenment, how much was accomplished then. It's the spirit of the times, not any kind of tangible way, but when you have 100 or 200 people who are communicating with each other indirectly about music or about ideas or anything, they all influence each other, even if, like you said, Kant didn't have anything to do with music and Mozart didn't have all that much to do with philosophy, but those ideas are evolving among the most intellectually active people, and they have an influence. Just like today in our society, there's lots of people who would say, I'm not Christian at all, or I'm not Jewish at all, I don't have the Judeo-Christian background. But the ideas that are behind that are still influencing your life, because they're just so seeped into our culture that there's no way to avoid some of those ideas. I think it's at least that connection.
I was fascinated by your explanation of when you get to a section and you're not sure exactly how it should be played, that for a philosophical lecture, you're reasoning out the proper way to play it, as opposed to just playing it two or three different ways and saying, hey, this sounds best. So there's sort of an aesthetic way to decide and an intellectual way to decide. And for the philosophical group, you took the intellectual route.
Thank you. Okay, we have time for one more question.
I love this because I had written off Mozart as just a mathematician, kind of a formulaic composer. So tell us, what are some of his other sublime pieces in your opinion?
Well, we all have our favorites. We can go around the... Why don't we go around the... I'll tell you that... Luella, do you want to...
What's the concerto, from the piano concerto, several of the piano concertos, slow movements of the piano concertos, extraordinary.
One of Mozart's biographers, earliest great biographer, was named Alfred Einstein, not Albert, but Alfred Einstein. And he wrote that every piano concerto Mozart wrote, beginning with number 9, was one of the greatest masterpieces of all of music. So you can't go wrong with any of the piano concertos 9 through 27. Violin concertos that he wrote at age 19 are considered his first masterpieces, and it's an early style, a pastoral style, especially the slow movement of each one of those. The Sinfonia Concertante, K364, for viola and violin and orchestra, is sublime. His last three symphonies that he wrote just a year after this, 39, 40, and 41, are the greatest symphonies ever written. His operas are the greatest operas ever written, starting with Marriage of Figaro, Don Giovanni, Così fan tutte, and The Magic Flute. Go hear them. Go see Amadeus, which has the Mozart Requiem and the Piano Concerto No. 20, which are both very dark pieces in D minor. Someone called Amadeus, a critic I like, he said it's a ridiculous film that has no basis in historical fact that I've seen 36 times.
The clip, I have a little, one last question then to clear up one last thing on Mozart. The image of him even carrying on conversations and writing his music at the same time as if he could do that. Is there any biographical truth to that?
You almost said biological, yeah. And that's a good question. How did he do it? He said that he would compose a piece in his mind. It would be fully formed. And he would then write it out while composing another piece in his mind at the same time. I had one of the great experiences of my life was this past year, Zina and I were performing the Mozart duo in a concert, and I learned from reading the preface to our score that the original manuscript it was in the J.P. Morgan Library in New York. And so I had to get permission to go see it. And I explained that it was for a performance. I wanted to see what his actual manuscript. And then I had to go through about 5 different double doors and wash my hands. But there I was. There was no protection. Wasn't behind a screen or anything. And I was left with this holy scripture and could see his actual hand. He wrote very small. You could see that he wrote very quickly. There were no erasures, and he would write little shortcuts because he just wanted to get through and get it on paper and get to the thing he was probably already composing in his mind. There's general agreement that this was one of the greatest minds that our civilization has ever produced.
That's a perfect way to end. Another event at the Commonwealth Club of California. Thank you very much, and thanks to the online and radio audiences. Thank you, Steve. And so ends another event of the Commonwealth Club in its 109th year of enlightened discussion.